on Monday. This is the last panel for tonight. There's one more panel. There's two more panels on Monday, both at exactly the same time. Those of you who got the program we were handing out earlier and ran out of copies of, there was a misprint on one of them. But at 2:30 tomorrow in this room, we'll have multimodal literacy, teaching multimodal literacy with comics. We'll also have a panel in the science fiction literature track room on how to be a science fiction scholar, which should be very interesting. I'm going to introduce our panelists. Our format is going to be they're going to give their presentations, which they've prepared ahead of time, and then we'll reserve question and answer for the entire panel to the end. Please make sure to keep questions in mind for the first couple of presentations. You write them down or think them real hard till they stick. Should be great. Okay, so our presenters today are Durf Humphreys, who's an independent scholar in history. His topic is Cold War ideologies and Silver Age Green Lantern. We've got Clancy Smith from Belmont University in Nashville, and he's in the philosophy department there. And we've got Mary Grace Dupree from the Religious Studies Department at Georgia State University. Oh, Clancy's paper is on Days of Future Past, Technocracy and Discrimination in X-Men in America. Mary Grace Dupree's topic is Holy Coded my tongue and brain are not working very well anymore. Holy Coded Jewish Identity Batman, tracing the narrative of religious presence in comics. So without further ado, I'm going to turn things over first to Durf Humphreys.
Hopefully you have some familiarity with the Green Lantern and have some familiarity with American history. My argument will be a little oversimplified because it's only, I'm going to try and keep it short. Hopefully. We'll see. I'm an American. If you're wanting to question that, you may question that later on here. Today I'm going to talk about the United States and different ideas regarding what it means to be an American. I love this country. I consider myself very patriotic. I served this country in the Peace Corps. I volunteer a lot. I love America. I've taught American history to people around the world. When I speak of Americanness, I'm not talking about patriotism. Rather, I'm referring to a perception of the United States collectively constructed by local and foreign definitions of American identity as informed by both actual and imagined realities. The perception is in constant flux and must be considered in context, and the context must be allowed to contradict itself occasionally as it encompasses many opposing ideologies. When tasked with identifying the most American superhero, we are looking for a superhero that richly embodies the most distinctly American elements. Remember, American is not a synonym for good. Contrary to what Fox News will tell you, American and good are two different words. It does not mean honest. It does not mean strong. It does not mean heroic. American as an identifier is created by those who love America, but also by those who hate and feel indifferently about our country. If you asked Osama bin Laden, Joseph Stalin, or Hulk Hogan what it means to be an American beyond originating in the Americas, they will give you very different answers. So my answer to this relatively inconsequential and elementally flawed question, who is the most American superhero? My answer is the Green Lantern. More generally, I'd say the Lanterns of Space Sector 2814, including Adam Sir and Star Sapphire Carol Ferris. But most specifically today, I want to talk about Hal Jordan. But it is he's part of a bigger narrative, from the Golden Age classics with magical Green Lantern Alan Scott to today's stories featuring Simon Baz. I believe the Green Lantern narrative is more closely tied to the United States' perception of itself and its role as a world power than any other comic book superhero. And this is not the only way to define the American identity, but it's the framework that I'll be using here. We're looking for something less obvious than Wonder Woman's outfit, right? We're looking less obvious than Captain America's military surface. What does it mean to be an American besides being a flag? We're going to look at some cultural artifacts here. Okay, let's look at some American artifacts. First, we have the airplane. It was invented in the United States. And we'll talk a little bit more about the U.S. love affair with aeronautics in a second, but let's keep it simple. Hal Jordan is a pilot. Next, we have football, a sport so American, the rest of the world calls it American football, right? We also have objectivism, The philosophy of Ayn Rand, a Russian immigrant who loved this country zealously, and its text, The Fountainhead, which celebrates an architect with a very strong willpower. Okay? We have Siegel and Schuster's great gift, the superhero comic book. Sequential art begins to appear in many different cultures, but let's be honest, we do it the best, right? And then we have, you know, Henry Ford's miracle, right? The Motor City's mighty automobile, symbol of American industrial superiority. You all know where I'm going with this, right? Okay, Guy Gardner, right? All these artifacts correlate with the Green Lanterns of Earth. Guy Gardner is a former football star and a police officer. John Stewart is an architect and a former Marine. Kyle Rayner is a sensitive artist. And our Arab Green Lantern is he build cars? No, he steals them, yes, because he's not white. And we know how comics work in that way, right? And all of them have connections to the government. Hal's in the Air Force, Guy's a cop, and he's not just any kind of cop. He's the Irish cop dynasty archetype that America loves, right? He's Officer Crumkey. His dad is Officer Crumkey, and his sister's Officer Crumkey. And then we have Kyle, or John. John's a Marine. Kyle, his dad was in the CIA. In Red Sun, which is an Elseworlds story, Kyle's a Marine himself. And Simon, our Arab-American friend, he sort of thwarts a terrorist attack, sort of helping the government, and sort of apprehending this sort of domestic terrorist. And I tried to reconstruct this abstract assessment of the American essence in the years during the Silver Age of superhero comic books, which for our purposes begins in 1956. Let's look for a second at the years leading up to the Silver Age and the development of the superhero's capacity to be American. During the Second World War, superheroes were very popular, and patriotic superheroes were particularly popular. If you were here for the last panel, you saw a little bit of that. The good and evil dynamic of the Allied versus Axis powers ran congruent with the good and evil dynamic in superhero comics. But following the war, enemies became more difficult for the public imagination to identify. Politicians and comic book creators alike struggled with ways to define the post-war global political climate. Superhero comics fell out of favor while Western and romance stories enjoyed popularity among DC's America's comic readers, and during the lull between the Golden and Silver Age, DC drastically reduced its superhero titles down to the trinity of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman as the only titles, solo titles. Now, following military victories in Europe and the Pacific, America gained a role in world politics and perhaps a disproportionate level of confidence in relation to that role. With this new power, the U.S. occasionally acted recklessly and sometimes even against its own interests. Whatever criticism you want to lob at the U.S. for its post-war foreign policy, it's difficult to deny that the U.S. demonstrated a very strong will. Their ability to overcome great fear, maybe not so much. As I mentioned before, the good and evil dynamic worked for both the war propaganda machine and the comic book industry, which were sometimes one and the same. Post-war realities caused many loyalties to change, and let's look at the most significant, I think, which is that Russia and China, which had been allies during World War II, became the official enemies of the United States, while Germany and Japan, identified as monstrous aggressors during the war, are now painted as allies. Even, maybe they are the Robin to our Batman. Right? These are our little pet countries that we would try to build up after World War II. The use of extreme military tactics by the U.S. against both Germany and Japan challenged many of the ideas Americans held about their country's moral direction. Communist victories in China and the Korean Peninsula additionally complicated the U.S. attempts to exert global influence. While the Chinese and North Korean military posed a threat to U.S. allies like South Korea and Japan, the U.S. government had to sell the urgency of yet another foreign war to the American people. And to the Japanese people, incidentally, as well. The Korean War so befuddled American policy, it would later take 11 years of television to reconcile that war. American influence continued to expand into developing countries, as did the communist influence that the United States government perceived as such a great threat. Publicity hounds, ambitious politicians and other forces in U.S. society latched onto the sphere of communism in their crusade fad of the 50s, resurrecting attitudes from the original Red Scare decades earlier, while people like Richard Nixon and Joseph McCarthy utilized the fear of communism. They depicted people living under communism as being the most terrified people of all. A very simplified summary of their dichotomous worldview could be, capitalist democracies are maintained by the strength of the individual will. while communist dictatorships are maintained by fear of the collective and of the state. In an initiative to prevent future conflicts after the Second World War, the world powers returned to the idea of an overseeing government like the League of Nations attempted after the First World War. Globalizing institutions like the United Nations, NATO, GATT, the World Bank, and others strive to make order out of chaos. We can see similarities between the United Nations Security Council and the Guardians of the Universe. We see similarities between NATO and the Green Lantern Corps, and later we can see similarities between multinational conglomerates and Larfleeze's Orange Lantern Corps. And the Red Lanterns look a lot like the Zapatistas, Sendero Luminoso, Al-Qaeda, the IRA. And interestingly enough, I don't know how this fits into my research, but the Guardians are actually based on Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. But moving on. 50 years after the Wright brothers' first flight, the U.S. continued to bask in its aeronautical glory and had begun to craft its industry alongside this novel invention. U.S. military superiority could be seen in military planes. U.S. morality could be seen in the Berlin airlift. U.S. technological superiority and innovation could be seen in high-speed jets, while U.S. courage could be seen in the pilots that tested them. Pilots like aviation legend Chuck Yeager, whose resemblance to Hal Jordan is pretty clear. Superheroes return to the... We're going to skip this one. The Flash is the first Silver Age superhero that comes back. This is an interest to make sure that these folks get to talk. But Flash comes first, Hal Jordan comes second. Hal Jordan embodies a recognizable contemporary masculinity, a brave man whose fearlessness only aids in his hot dogging and his tail chasing. Jordan's life is forever changed when his courage is challenged by the great responsibility of harnessing the most powerful weapon in the universe. Sounds like a country I know, right? For Hal, receiving the ring from Abin Sur gives him both a sense of purpose and justification for his arrogance. For the U.S., the responsibility that accompanied the accomplishments in regards to nuclear weapons provides a similar sense of purpose and justification for arrogance. Abin Sur also represents an older and ceremonial order, passing the responsibility to Hal Jordan, a reckless and confident newcomer, much like the Western powers watching their power slip into the hands of our cocky United States. Margaret Thatcher once described the difference between Europe and the U.S. by identifying Europe as a product of history and the United States as a product of philosophy. While the U.S. is a nation of many philosophies, I'm going to use a very simplified interpretation of what philosophy the U.S. is a product of, sort of a pragmatism, objectivism, Federalist Papers, deist kind of philosophy. This is an article from William Marston, who created Wonder Woman. And this is something that appeared in a Green Lantern comics about willpower, how it's going to make your life so amazing. And it talks about great Americans. American school children, George Washington, and Ulysses S. Grant. Kind of as a way to say this is what shaped the American frontier. And Earth, as you know, it becomes increasingly important, right? As it becomes the vertus for the 52 multiverses. As the United States and other Western capitalist nations are to be identified as drawing their strength from willpower, those same nations portray the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and other communist nations as drawing their strength from fear. American political rhetoric works to manufacture enemies out of these countries, and to do that, powerful voices dominate American political discourse with depictions of communist nations as living unnatural lives, as dictated by the state, living in a world where right is left, down is up, and it is simply terrified. This dialectical opposition, fear and willpower. It's a bit like fear and love in Donnie Darko. I mean, what is their true relationship to each other? But it works for the Green Lantern's legacy, and it works for the terms of our conversation. So if Green Lantern Corps are the Western capitalists, who are these communist people? Okay. In the second issue of Green Lantern, the antimatter universe and its planet Quarter introduces opposite versions of our matter-filled universe in Green Lantern's homeworld Oa. On the planet Quarter, humanoids live under unthinkable conditions, unthinkable because they are unquantifiable and abstract, much like a world where willpower is used as a currency. Many of these humanoids presumably like these conditions, but not all of them. In the first appearance of the Quardians, one of them crosses a sort of cosmic Berlin Wall to request aid from the Green Lantern. The Green Lantern is amazed, and you see the panel here, to see that our world is ruled along the principles of good instead of evil. And a lot of Americans imagined, you know, communist nations, oh, they're just evil all the time. But they sleep evilly, they eat evilly, they fuck evilly. And a small resistant group comes later to the small resistant group has revealed this issue to oppose the lawful evil that's imposed upon them. In the next issue, some spies come to try to steal our technology. And a class of Quardians known as Weaponers exist to serve the multiple functions of Stormtrooper, Port Warrior, and most importantly, munitions industry. The Weaponers' most noted weapon is a yellow ring that harnesses the power of fear. A disgraced renegade Green Lantern named Sinestro finds himself exiled on Quard and is given the ring that wields the yellow light of fear by the Weaponers. He bears a striking resemblance to Russian leader and Marxist icon Vladimir Lenin. The gift of the ring is not so different from the Soviet Union arming its allies in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, or later installing nuclear weapons in Cuba, which happened after Sinestro's introduction. But while this renegade Green Lantern wields the yellow light of fear, his costume is initially black and blue, and his skin is bright communist red. In a post-9/11 Geoff Johns sculpted universe, Sinestro's skin has become more pink. The costume reflects the yellow lantern from which he draws his power. The conflict between Sinestro and Hal Jordan is defined by how evenly matched they are, a green versus a yellow, mutually assured destruction that demands subtle yet aggressive diplomacy. Much like the communist nations in the United States, Sinestro and Green Lantern shared a great deal of history. Sinestro was married to the sister of Abin Sur, the Green Lantern who gave Hal Jordan his ring. And now the third world, right? In the issue 14 of The Green Lantern, the fictional Balkan nation of Medora is introduced alongside a deeply nationalist and deeply resentful clockmaker that calls Medora his home. Medora is depicted the way many third world nations are understood by Americans at that time, and I think still now. My wife is from a city of 1 million people that Americans refer to as a village. So Americans often view the developing world as being traditional, living under tyrannical and inept local governments, superstitious, technologically backwards. The nation is so small, Medora, they only have one stamp, which they eventually give to the Green Lantern. The clockmaker despises his neighbors and desperately wants to advance his country. He adopts the villainous identity of Sonar and employs audio technology to wreak havoc on the affluent and arrogant West. He's a directionalist terrorist acting out like a wild animal with toys that are too dangerous for him to play with.
A little bit like Mark Rubio?
Sorry now. Let's talk about Hal Jordan's uncle. I'm sorry, his assistant, Tom. Alternately, Hal's Eskimo buddy, Pieface, is portrayed as a loyal friend, a hard worker, and devoted husband. Pieface assimilates to the predominantly white Coast City community realistically, while preserving his Eskimo culture in a way no hokier than any displays of dominant American culture in comics. Now, the Cold War was gendered on all sides, from Mao's declaration that women hold up half the sky to the naming of the bikini after the Bikini Atoll and the nuclear tests performed there. Gender realities and imagined realities pervaded the experience of living through the Cold War. The experience of American women is far too vast for me to sum up here. So let's simply look at the depiction of one woman in the Green Lantern narrative and see what we can conclude about the way women were perceived in the 1960s. Hal Jordan faces a problem new to the American male in the 1960s. A female boss. Luckily for Hal, she's a smoking hot fox, and the term sexual harassment will not be coined until 1973. Carol Ferris is presented as a capable boss. She did not earn the position at Ferris Aircraft, so much as receive the position from her father. But to be fair, Hal is also following in his father's footsteps. They're both saddled with serious daddy issues, as well as suffering from buffoonish sexual tension that looms around somebody, either Highball Hal Jordan or the equally handsome Green Lantern, the same person, putting a ring on Carol Ferris's finger, an engagement ring, right? They're going to get married. Hal easily gets Carol to break her no-dating employees policy, but her attention is quickly stolen by the Green Lantern. To everyone's surprise, particularly Carol's, she does not indeed receive a ring. She does indeed receive a ring, but not from Hal or from Green Lantern, nor is it a wedding ring. Carol is visited by the Zamorons in Green Lantern number 16, given a ring that wields the violet power of love. It turns out that romantic love is the most important thing to a woman. I don't know if you knew that already. Even if she runs a major aircraft company. And romantic love has an interesting effect on women. Since women have no control over their emotions, they allow love to turn them into self-obsessed, controlling, jealous, evil bitches. Additionally, love compels them to dress in eye-catching outfits. What does it say about the way women are perceived that the Star Sapphire's outfit has gotten sexier and sexier? Throughout the publication of The Green Lantern, gender has been confronted in jaw-dropping ways and deserves its own panel. If for no other reason than to discuss... And that's your boyfriend?
Your husband.
Your husband?
Yeah.
I'm married too, I understand. is Arisha Robb, Hal Jordan's 13-year-old alien girlfriend, who artificially ages herself to pass on Earth without drawing attention from law enforcement groups. Sounds legit. Her outfit is also quite eye-catching. But let's skip forward to April 1970. We're going to skip a lot of the 60s here and get to the end of the, what I consider sort of the end of Silver Age Green Lantern. With the publication of Green Lantern 76, Neil Adam and Denny O'Neil's iconic issue where Green Lantern is joined by the modern-day Robin Hood, the Green Arrow. By 1970, the United States had become pretty suspicious that the Iron Curtain and the Emperor's New Clothes may have been stitched by similar tailors. Hostile race relations domestically and the war in Vietnam had led many Americans to question the validity of the U.S. government's rhetoric and the sincerity of America's promises to the world and to itself. Hal Jordan had joined the establishment when it was cool. And Oliver Queen has arrived to tell Hal Jordan that the establishment is no longer cool. In a, this is sort of the, like one of the most iconic panels in all of comics, right? Hal Jordan, this guy who's been helping out, people with from all other parts of the world, but he hasn't done anything to fix race relations, right? So Hal is consumed by shame, realizing he's wasted his life, you know, saving the universe. culminating in Green Arrow convincing Hal and one of the Guardians, the least square of all the Guardians, Gambit, to go take a road trip in search of the soul of America. One of the greatest runs in comic books history ensues, and it involves some coal mines, Vista, junkie wards, folk singers, a racist drug cult, and depictions of the establishment as a total bummer. This is something I read on The Onion. This guy who had some problem with his friends, and he said, when you're ready to have a serious conversation about the Green Lantern, you know my email address. So I offer that with you. This is a drawing I did of a woman from Viet.com. If you're familiar with this website, if you're not and you like cosplay, these are really, really fun girls. I interviewed them for my site, and they do a nude, non-sexual cosplay. And we became friends. They found out about me because I like to draw pictures of Arisha Robb, and I found out about them because they like to take naked pictures dressed as Arisha Robb. you can see my blog for more of my bizarre interpretations of comic books. And if you want to talk about the Green Lantern, I welcome the discourse, and I happily pass it on to one of my colleagues.
Okay, so our next presentation is going to be by Clancy Smith, Days of Future Past, Technocracy and Discrimination in X-Men and America. Let me just flip back to our... Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
The year is 2013. Amid the devastation of New York City, the last remaining X-Men gather for one final desperate attempt to save a world on the brink of nuclear annihilation. In this city-wide concentration camp, a wheelchair-bound man emerges from the shadows, the leader of the X-Men, Eric Lencher, known as Magneto. He whispers gravely, "If there were any alternative, we would take it. But if we do nothing, by tomorrow, the world will be at war. And the day after tomorrow, the world will be dead." In one of the most iconic... What a terrible mutant power. Can you hear me? Is this working? Oh, is it working? Okay. He's a terrible mutant power. In one of the most iconic storylines in the long history of the X-Men, one of the most celebrated fails in comics history, what looks to be one of the most epic, badass movies ever made about comic book heroes coming next summer, writer Chris Claremont and artist John Byrne take us to the very edge of oblivion and show us a glimpse of the future should Professor Xavier fail to prevent the final confrontation between humanity and mutant kind. It provides a definitive answer to the question, what if the X-Men lost? What sort of world would be created if humanity's hatred and fear compelled them to commit the most horrific atrocities? Claremont creates a dystopian future where mutants and humans alike are confined to concentration camps in a world governed by the iron fist of the Sentinels, created by humanity to provide the final solution to the mutant problem, where all are forced to have a letter emblazoned on their clothing or tattooed on their skin, reflecting the badges on the prisoners' clothes and the barcodes tattooed across their arms in Nazi Germany. Claremont presents two parallel narratives, the present, 1981, and the future, 2013. Ominous. No. In the present, tensions simmer between the United States government and the perceived mutant threat as Xavier seeks to stem the rising tide of anti-mutant legislation at a congressional hearing. In the future, the Sentinels threaten to instigate a nuclear response from what little remains of humanity, heralding the potential end of all life on Earth. Procuring advanced technology, the last vestiges of the X-Men, led by their one-time antagonist Magneto, send Kate Pryde's consciousness back in time to inhabit the body of her younger self in a desperate effort to avert a catastrophic attack by the Brotherhood at the very same congressional hearing Xavier is attending. Rather than exploring this theme through the eyes of one of the more iconic characters, we get to see this narrative unfold through the eyes of the innocent. Kitty Pryde, a wide-eyed neophyte, joins the team just prior to the events of Days of Future Past. Naive, idealistic, and full of hope, the use of Pryde as the protagonist of the tale adds another dimension to Claremont's exploration of this dystopian future by directly juxtaposing Pryde's hopeful optimism as a child with the jaded, battle-worn Kate Pryde of the future. In short, we come to see the death of innocence itself. It's very deep. Apparently in the movie, they're changing this. Spoilers. Over your ears. Yeah, well, Hugh Jackman is sexier, I guess, than Kate Pryde or whatever. So he's going to be the... Okay. Spoilers. Sorry. That's what I hear. I know. After I made that good point about why it's important. Part one. Times they are a-changing. Chris Claremont was 18 years old when Dylan's iconic song was written, capturing the zeitgeist of the age as Claremont began his degree in political theory at Bard College in a social atmosphere unlike any our nation had seen before, an atmosphere manifest through every page of this tale. Although the height of the civil rights movement had passed by the time of its publication, the title itself, Days of Future Past, may be read as not only a reflection of the ongoing struggle for freedom and equality, but too, an ominous warning against the threat of the past repeating itself in the future. It is a testament to the enduring struggle of any minority group fighting for equal rights within a legal system bound beyond their control. So many of us identify with the outsider, those that don't fit into the accepted cultural milieu, our lifestyles labeled as deviant in comparison, our freedoms limited to what we are told by those unlike ourselves must be the norm. It is a timeless theme that I maintain provides the X-Men with its timeless appeal. As Claremont says, quote, X-Men has always been about finding your place in a society that doesn't want you, end quote. The year Days of Future Past was published was the same year Ronald Reagan took office. Reagan inherited the struggles of his predecessors, having to face both enduring discrimination and advances in technology that continued to push us to the brink of nuclear war. Indeed, the year of its publication saw the assassination attempt on the life of President Reagan just weeks after the release of this two-part comic storyline, of which terrifying, I'm not saying because, it's not like a Catcher in the Rye thing, guys, it's not that, of which terrifying parallels may be seen in the assassination attempt on the life of Senator Kelly by the Brotherhood as the pivotal moment where history began barreling towards Armageddon. Part two, otherness, fighting for a world that hates and fears you. No matter how valiantly the X-Men fight, ultimate victory ever eludes them. In essence, they are undone by the very terms of their purpose, by the very bind of their existence. They fight for a world that hates and that fears them. The greatest enemy the X-Men face doesn't wear a mask or a gaudy costume. The enemy that they face is hate, and their enemy is fear. Until the means of perpetuating hate and fear are dissolved, the X-Men can never achieve the victory they seek. As X-Men editor Mark Powers notes, quote, "There's a certain darkness, because the X-Men's true enemy is hate, which is something that's never going to go away," end quote. For throughout it all, the fear-mongers and hate proliferators, terrified of losing power, fan the flames of intolerance based on the belief that what is different is threatening, and what is threatening must be utterly destroyed. What is the other? There are innumerable philosophical texts that explore the topic of otherness from a variety of perspectives, and thus only a cursory evaluation can be attempted here. Traditionally, on the most fundamental level, the other is all that is not myself. It is the resistance I encounter from outside myself that demarcates where I end and where what is not myself begins. As such, it plays a pivotal role in how I define myself. Seeing myself as I am, seeing myself as I am not, and perhaps most importantly, seeing myself through the eyes of this other and attempting to reconcile that with how I see myself. For some, encountering the other is necessary for growth and development, for it is only through productive dialogue that we together may move towards greater heights of truth and understanding. For some, the other represents an obstacle that must be overcome, a hindrance that threatens my subjectivity. Mutants are seen as this sort of obstacle, a challenge to the hegemony of mankind, and qualities of each specific mutant are reduced to the terms of bare otherness. Senator Kelly does not see a difference between the X-Men and the Brotherhood, hero and villain, simply the blanketing otherness that represents, in his mind, a genuine threat to his own kind's hold on power. Should the latter engagement with otherness unfold, over time the traits of the more powerful of the two become the established norm, what things ought to be, and the traits of the other become measured against this established normativity. What constitutes normativity is in large part culturally conditioned, but always reflects the traits of this power class. These are the traits of what King called the power majority, against which all else is judged, specifically the traits that power minorities do not share with those of the majority, maleness, whiteness, etc. King responded to segregation statutes by defining them as unjust laws, quote, "a code that a numerical or power majority group compels a minority group to obey, but that does not make binding on itself. This is difference made legal," end quote. Precisely what the Mutant Registration Act signifies. The proliferation of a false and artificially constructed self-identity, what scholars such as George Yancey refer to as an imago, an elaborate distorted image, helped convince minorities of their essential inferiority, both in the eyes of the majority and, far more devastating, instilling a sense of inferiority in the minorities themselves whenever they see themselves through the eyes of the majority. As Frantz Fanon once noted, quote, "not only must the black man be black, he must be black in relation to the white man," end quote. As Claremont notes, quote, "the X-Men are hated, feared, and despised collectively by humanity for no other reason than they are mutants." So what we have here, intended or not, is a book that is about racism, bigotry, and prejudice, end quote. The imago for mutant kind seems clear enough. Mutants are dangerous, criminal, and threaten mankind through their very existence. Derogatory terms like muties and freaks, used by humans throughout the tale, without differentiating, as Senator Kelly cannot, between the Brotherhood and the X-Men, despite Storm's protest that, quote, "mutants, like people, are both good and bad. You would do well to remember that, Senator, before you seek to condemn us all," end quote. Kelly sees mutants in their pure otherness, without distinctions and without the attribution of moral ambiguity that he would give his own people. They are all alike, essentially villainous, and universally seen as antagonists to the human race. Rather than demonstrating his gratitude towards the X-Men for saving his life, he responds, quote, "but if there were no mutants in the first place, my life wouldn't have been threatened at all," end quote. In Kelly's speech in favor of mutant registration, he says, quote, "there is no place for ordinary men and women in a world of mutants who have abilities which set them apart, some would say above, the rest of humanity," end quote. Humanity fears allowing the other the recognition the other desires, for if left free, the other may rise past humanity, perhaps, as Kelly fears, may even destroy it. In short, he fears allowing mutant kind to do to humanity what humanity is already doing to mutant kind. The X-Men fight for a world that hates and fears them. But why do this? The X-Men and the Brotherhood share the same goal, a world where mutants live free from the fear of human persecution. The Brotherhood believe they can force this outcome by teaching humanity to fear mutants even more than they already do, to instill so much fear that humanity would never dare to challenge mutant autonomy. This is why Xavier is key to the X-Men's project, not simply because he was the founder of the group, but far more importantly, his vision, which is referred to, not coincidentally, as Xavier's dream, is uniquely situated against the Brotherhood's agenda. If hatred is based on the fear of otherness, to increase that fear will only increase the hatred that is fueled by it, which is precisely the outcome that leads to the dystopian future in Days of Future Past. To dissolve the fear that founds humanity's hatred for Xavier is the only way to achieve mutant equality. The parallel with King's role in the civil rights movement is immediately clear and profoundly compelling. Acting as the gadfly, a term he took from Plato's iconic protagonist Socrates, King's project was to shake America free from the passive acceptance of such imagos and the unacceptable status quo of inequality. King's method was one of nonviolence, not wanting to add to the false imago of the essential aggressiveness and irrationality of Black Americans. He appealed instead to compassion, education, and civil disobedience. As Andrew Godofsky notes, like King, quote, Xavier does not advocate proactive violence, for it only serves to further divide humans and mutants and drive the fear that brings about his brethren's persecution, end quote. Consider the team that Claremont assembles for the story, itself a vibrant display of ethnic diversity. You have Blue Nightcrawler and metal-skinned Colossus, and the team leader is Storm, and a Canadian midget with claws. A whole bunch of stuff. For the most part, their powers are uniquely designed for non-lethal combat to protect humanity from villainous mutants without further fueling humanity's fear of what mutants are capable of doing. Only Wolverine violates this pattern. His entire comportment is designed specifically to take lives, which becomes a point of great contention in the story. Storm even prevents him from killing one of the Brotherhood, an act championed by fellow X-Men Angel, who says, quote, with the country's growing anti-mutant sentiment, the last thing we need is Wolvie carving someone up, even if it is a villain, end quote. Again, Storm confronts Wolverine a moment later. She says, quote, sheathe your claws or use them on me. You should not need them except in the most extreme of situations and the most powerful of foes, end quote. Like King, Xavier dreamed of a world where children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. The association between King and Xavier is anything but coincidental. As Claremont himself notes in an interview with New York Magazine, quote, to use Martin Luther King's idea, judge them by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, he pauses, or the number of arms they have. Part 3, Rise of the Sentinel. As the situation in Congress continues to deteriorate, Moira turns to Xavier, whispering ominously, registration of mutants today, gas chambers tomorrow, end quote. Xavier responds calmly, saying, be charitable, Moira. He's scared. We must teach him that his fear is unfounded. It can be argued that Magneto's entire motivational spectrum stems from his early experiences with Nazi occupation and his desire to ensure that mutantkind does not suffer the same fate as his Jewish people. Precisely what does happen in the narrative. As such, his role as villain is deeply problematic. No longer numbered among the sociopathic costumed lunatics clamoring for world domination for the sheer one-dimensional glory of villainy, Magneto embarks upon a quest to ensure at any cost that history does not repeat itself, that the days of the future do not come to repeat the days of the past. Magneto adopts a more cynical attitude towards the potential realization of Xavier's dream and finds a more plausible solution in the violent suppression of humankind. It was the Brotherhood's plan, quote, to teach humanity to fear and respect the power of Homo Superior. Their plan backfired. Mutants became objects of fear and hatred, end quote. Quite simply, Claremont demonstrates that the Brotherhood's method cannot, on principle, attain the goal it sets out to achieve. If the hatred humanity feels towards mutants is based upon fear, and if that fear is fueled by the exertion of violence, violence will only further perpetuate that fear and with it increase humanity's hatred of mutantkind. Both Xavier and the Brotherhood use the word teach in response to Kelly's form of discrimination. For Xavier, it was the promise of enlightenment through peaceful dialogue. For the Brotherhood, it was a thinly veiled threat of force to demonstrate that mutants would not passively accept humanity's intolerance. Intriguing, then, to see Magneto's role in the future portion of the story. He has become the leader of the X-Men, even coming to mirror Xavier's physical comportment, bound to a wheelchair, a powerful image that Claremont creates to complete the reversal of Magneto's abandonment of his fundamental ideology. Conclusion. Hope. Claremont presents a potential solution in the form of going back into the past. At first, this may seem naive and deeply problematic. As a social commentary, we here cannot go back into the past and alter the trajectory of time leading to the present moment. But a more charitable reading, and I believe a more interesting one, does not advocate the impossible task of returning to the past, but rather offers a cautionary tale about avoiding such events in order to prevent that future from ever unfolding. We fight on, not by altering the past, but by remembering it and ensuring that it never repeats itself, that the days of the past never become the days of the future. Perhaps the X-Men are heroes precisely because they continue to fight in the face of impossibility. There will always be outsiders, those who are different, those who struggle and fight for recognition and equality in a world that seems stacked against them. And the X-Men will always represent those of us who don't fit neatly into the norm. As Claremont said, quote, "Looking at the story again from years ago, when I was thinking about finishing it, I suddenly realized, how can you have a hero who's helpless? What the X-Men were about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, was about being against forces beyond their control. What they're about now is transcending that, finding a way to win no matter what. Even in the face of the greatest adversity, the key is to never lose hope, never lose sense of the dream that drives you, that whatever happens, we'll find a way to win."
Now I will hand things over to our final presenter, Mary Grace Dupree.
Thanks. I think I'm the socio part of the socio-political lens, because I don't know anything about politics, but I do know some religion, because if you say socio, I think religion automatically. A story to start with. My friend Michael Bergen is the film editor at Paste magazine, and he was invited to sneak preview for Man of Steel. This is a little unusual sneak preview because, unlike most sneaks, it was not handled by the studio. It was not Warner Brothers. It was being handled by the local Christian radio station. I think it's called The Fish or something like that. And Michael was very uncomfortable at this sneak preview, not least because he was one of the few critics there. With almost without exception, the rest of the audience was drawn from the station's listeners and sponsors, and also because of the man sitting next to him, who began to be curious about the state of Michael's soul about halfway through the movie and to start this conversation with him. And it's interesting because that was obviously intentional on Warner Brothers' part to hand off the sneak that way. It was part of an explicit court the Christians strategy, which, if you've seen the movie, it's pretty obvious that's what was going on. And I mention this because I think it's very easy for us to use that Christological framework to look at superheroes, whether it's in the comics or animation or the movies, and sort of wedge that framework onto there, forgetting that really at its root we're talking about an essentially Jewish genre. And many times I don't think that that's done, that the Christological framework is wedged on there because, say, the studio has some overarching Christian agenda and they really want to make sure you get Jesus before you leave that theater. I think it's done because that's part of our grab bag of symbols. And they know they can reach for those symbols, and everyone will understand what they're saying and will get their larger point and be able to nod along. It's more part of the cultural baggage that they're bringing there, except for, you know, the listeners to The Fish, who are obviously bringing a whole lot of other baggage into that. So, hence what I'm talking about here, Golems and Groggers, Jewish folklore in the creation of superheroes. Also known as shameless generalizations about Superman and Batman, because what I'm about to embark on here is just a project of completely shameless generalization, which you should absolutely feel free to call me on. And please do. The heavy-handed symbolism of something like the Man of Steel aside, what do I mean when I say we're talking about an essentially Jewish genre? Well, at its simplest level, that means what? About the creators. I'm sure we can all name who we're talking about here when we talk about Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and Bob Kane and Bill Finger. These are obviously Jews. So at one level, and of course, sorry not to leave out Marvel, of course, the imaginative genius underlying all of Marvel, Stan Lee. So we've got Jews everywhere, but not much Jewishness in sight, or even much consciousness of Jewish identity, apparently. So students of religion and culture like myself get all excited when there is any appearance of religion in comics, which is not that apparent. So I just went through and pulled a couple of very recent examples of panels that got me all hand flappy when I saw them. My favorite, because of the bad bar mitzvah joke here. This is Professor Pig, one of Batman's most disturbing villains, and he's making this really horrible joke here when he says tohu va-bohu and boo-hoo-hoo. He's quoting the Hebrew of the opening verses of Genesis. That is the Hebrew for the earth was without form and void, tohu va-bohu. You know, only a former bar mitzvah boy could make this joke. They're aiming at quite the niche audience here, but again, interesting that you see just that little bit of intense Jewish awareness there. Here, I love this one. It's a commonplace that in Batman you're only going to see religion when there's a funeral or someone dies, so a lot. But again, this makes me excited because this is proof positive that the Waynes are Episcopalian. If you know anything about liturgical translations, the fact that it's Lord have mercy upon us, the upon is the tell, they're Episcopalians, nailed it. And then, of course, we get the one admission that Batman prays when Superman is, this is Titus has just attacked, this is when Superman is lying unconscious in a manly and quite lovely way here. And Batman, he says, in that moment, nothing was certain. There was little like it all for Superman, aside from prayer. And then, presumably answering the audience's wondering about this, he says quite defensively, yes, I prayed. It focuses the mind. If you must know. Of course, no word about what the framework of Batman's prayer is. One can imagine maybe Buddhist or, you know, in those times, maybe he turns back to Cranmer's prose of his childhood. Who knows? But I put these examples up here because they are so rare. Because when we see things like this, we think, aha! Because religion and religious practice in Golden Age or even Silver Age, Superman and Batman, and down to present day, is close to or entirely absent. And I would argue that that is not an accident, but is in fact a deep indication of the Jewish sensibility of Kane and Finger and Siegel and Shuster and modern writers as well. Those rare modern appearances just underscore the relative lack of religion's presence in this genre. So the question arises, how can we talk about comics as a Jewish genre when there doesn't appear to be any Jewishness or even any awareness of Jews, much to be honest, in the classic comic narratives? Well, those early creators, though they came from families with varying degrees of religious observance, arose out of a very specific Jewish cultural milieu. The Jewishness of these narratives is apparent and powerful if you know what you're looking at, but largely unseen if you don't. Of course, seeing biblical associations in these texts is nothing new. The Warner Brothers press team did not invent that. Scholars have looked at Superman and seen all sorts of associations, not just the Jesus one, but of course, what's the most famous one? The Moses, the little baby sent in the basket slash capsule to Earth slash Egypt, and all of that sent to deliver his people. And then, of course, there's a lot of Samson, as we saw in that opening slide, that overt Samson, you know, his powerful strength and all of that. His name, Kalel, a lot is made of the Hebrew connections there. It's a Hebrew name. It means voice of God, sort of. But the thing is, there isn't much scholarly talk about the biblical association that, in fact, I think is strongest in the creation of superheroes, and that is Esther. that we all think Batman would look nice dressed in that outfit there. For those who don't know, Esther is the story in the Bible of the young Jewish girl who wins the heart of the king of Persia through bridal lottery and becomes the queen of Persia, and then she gets to save her people, the Jews, from destruction because, as it turns out, the king's chief minister has decided that all the Jews should be destroyed, and she gets the job of speaking up and saying, "Don't destroy my people," in a world where speaking up endangered her life. It literally is a death sentence to speak without the king's scepter being extended towards you. And she speaks up bravely, she intercedes for her people, she saves the day, the Jews are not destroyed, yay, Esther. And it leads to the great Jewish festival of Purim today, which can be summarized as most Jewish festivals: they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. But here is the thing about Esther. It is the only book of the Bible that contains no mention of God. God's name does not appear in Esther at all. And it's easy to miss that because it's such a great story. You're like, go Esther, and she's trying to save her people, and so perhaps the religious context is there somewhere, but explicitly it's not. It is a narrative in which the hero takes center stage, a hero who triumphs and saves her people from certain destruction by her strength of mind, her will, and her courage. She is the representative and savior of her people, and she does it all on her own. There is no back and forth with God, as we see in the Moses story, which is an intensely relational story, right, of Moses and God. Moses can be summarized as, you know, boy meets bush, hijinks ensue. There is none of that moment in Esther, right? God doesn't come to Esther and say, you must save your people. There is no moment where she is instructed by God to do thus and so, where she receives the visitation of an angel. So, what does this have to do with early creation? Well, Siegel and Shuster, to talk about Superman for a minute, were high school students in 1933 when they created Superman. Superman was, of course, sold to DC in 38 when he first appeared. But they grew up in Jewish households in Cleveland, which was a hub of American Jewish life in early to mid-centuries. And one of the festivals that would have been a central part of their upbringing was Purim. Purim was huge with American Reformed Jews, and still is, probably because it's the one festival that isn't so huge on the God part. Many American Jews were and are ambivalent about stories of an anthropomorphic God speaking to someone from a burning bush or parting the seas, but come on, Esther, everybody can get behind that. There's no difficult theology to confront there, no painfully old-fashioned and old-country ways of talking about God to make American Reformed Jews feel uncomfortable. Purim is just pure festival. As you can see here, Purim is celebrated by dressing up. It is a literal religious duty to be as drunk as possible on this day. The height of it is a bawdy play, and if you thought my bad joke about extending the scepter was bad, you ought to see a rabbi in drag wearing a foam dong that he's beating people with. This happens all the time. So you can see on the left, this is from London's Stamford Hill community, which is obviously Orthodox. Even there, we've got some dancing on the table. We've got Tel Aviv here on the right, which is a little less Orthodox. You know, all sorts of dress-up happens on Purim. Purim became, in this country, a kind of Hanukkah, because just as Reformed Jews gave special weight to Hanukkah to counterbalance the growing cultural dominance of Christmas, so Purim became a replacement for Halloween, which is, of course, at base a Christian or at least secular holiday. So Purim began to occupy that place and became huge in the American Reformed Jewish community. Like Esther, Superman is frequently saddled with saving his people, in Esther's case the Jews, and Superman's the entire planet. Like Esther, Superman and Batman, for that matter, are what you might call assimilated. They look like they belong. No one knows that Esther is really a Jew because she looks and talks and acts just like a Persian. In the same way that, of course, Superman's alien identity is buried beneath the utterly normal-seeming Clark Kent. But the most obvious point of connection between Esther and Superhero is that hero's extreme self-reliance to the point of isolation. There's no deus ex machina, no one else coming to save the Jews or Metropolis or the planet. The hero has to figure out a way to conquer evil using only the tools they have. Granted, heat vision would have made that a lot easier for Esther, but she does okay. Esther must be God to her people in the exact same way that Superman must be God to his. So it's that very absence of God from the narrative of Esther and from the narrative of the superhero that makes Esther a better biblical point of connection than any of the other frequently proposed biblical analogs like Moses or Samson. That isolated self-reliance is a direct inheritance from Esther and a huge part of that Jewish cultural baggage that I believe Siegel and Shuster, as well as Cain and Finger, carried into their creations. There's a Hebrew term for that kind of Esther-like self-reliance and sense of duty, and it is called tikkun olam. Tikkun olam literally means the repair of the world, and it's a very ancient term that dates back at least to the 3rd century in the Mishnah, where it has some legal meanings. But the point is that by early modern times, the times that these superhero creators would have been writing in, it had come to mean something a little different. It means, literally, repair of the world. And it came to mean that thing that you individually are obligated to do to make the world a better place. Tikkun olam came to mean, for American Reformed Jews, the duty that Jews have to fix the world. Not in an evangelistic sense, like the great evangelistic religions of Christianity and Islam, but in the very Jewish sense of you must make this place, small place that you inhabit, a better place for having been in it, using your strength and your wits, not by relying on God to come and save you. So you can see why Reformed Jews, many of whom were growing in the early 20th century, very uncomfortable with the old country models of God. You know, you beg favors of God in prayer. If he's feeling good that day, he gives them to you. Would really attach themselves to this idea of tikkun olam. It's a way of attaching yourself to your religion without having to deal with much of the God baggage. And with its emphasis on self-reliance and on the power of the individual to effect change, the teaching of tikkun olam also spoke powerfully to American Jews who imbibed that same narrative of the do-it-yourself independent American as New England Protestants did. So I would argue that it's tikkun olam that lies in back of Superman's extraordinary sense of duty. He can change the world and therefore he must. Like Esther, he's uniquely placed in time and history to do his people's service. No one else can do it. It's his ability that uniquely obligates him to protect his people. Clark Kent is driven by a sense of duty that is at its core deeply religious and deeply intertwined with American Jewish ideals. I use the word protect there deliberately in reference to Superman's particular sense of tikkun olam, because that leads me to talking about the final and frequently unseen Jewish influence on early comics narratives. The Golem. The Golem is a story that every Jewish kid growing up in the early 20th century would have heard in one form or another. Golem is a Hebrew word just meaning formless shape or husk. There's a reference in the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin to the creation of a golem in which one rabbi sends a golem to another. It doesn't say like as a birthday gift, as a hitman, what. He simply arrives. But the point is the golem has a long history, but there is one most famous story connected with the golem, and this is one that all American Jewish kids would have known. And it's set in the late 1500s in Prague. And the story goes that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bezalel, or the Maharal, created a golem to protect the Jews of Prague from anti-Semitic attacks and pogroms. This golem's powers were tremendous. He had superhuman strength. He could appear and reappear at will, possibly because of super speed. And he could even summon the dead at will. In this story, the golem, for the first time, starts to look like a 20th century superhero. But the golem has one weakness. He can be deactivated. You can remove the scroll with the name of God from it that's stuffed into his mouth. In another version, he can be deactivated by erasing one of the letters from his forehead, so it spells not truth, emet, but death, met. In some versions, the golem even goes crazy and goes on rampages, and Rabbi Yehuda has to try and stop him using what amounts to Hebrew kryptonite, the knowledge of the names of God. But beyond these analogous powers, the golem shares with superheroes this idea of intense obligation to protect and defend, this core identification with the community. And the idea of a vulnerable community that requires a superpowered individual to protect it is very specific to Jewish culture and would have informed the imaginative world of Siegel and Shuster as well as Cain and Finger. One final thought before I stop flogging the horse of Jewish folklore here, and that is about names. It's not apparent in English translations of the Book of Esther, but this biblical heroine in fact has two names. Her Persian name is Esther, which is a variant of Ishtar, the Babylonian fertility goddess. Her Hebrew name, the name she would use among her own people, is Hadassah. This is an ancient commonplace of Jewish identity, to carry a name that is used publicly among non-Jews and another name, not necessarily a hidden one, that's used among Jews. You see this continually throughout Jewish culture, and in fact, one of the more famous examples is in the Christian New Testament with the Apostle Paul, or Paulus in the Latin, carrying a Roman name along with his Hebrew name, Shaul, or Saul. So the trope of the hidden identity, of the dual name that we see most clearly in Superman and Batman, is in fact an ancient Jewish custom that informs the elaborate identity play of these most iconic superheroes. And of course, it's not adequate to say that, for instance, Bruce Wayne is the mask and Batman is the real identity. Both are essential parts of the larger persona, just as both Clark Kent and Superman are indispensable parts of the same person. That very Jewish sense of living balanced between two names and two identities also appears in Golem stories, where it is the name that gives power and animates the golem. Change or erase that, and you change or erase his nature. So I would invite you, as you look at comics, to try wedging some of this framework onto them the next time someone sitting next to you tries to save your soul at watching Man of Steel.
So we're technically out of time, but because there's nothing scheduled in this room after this panel, we're gonna have some time for Q&A with the panelists. If you do need to leave, I understand, that's fine. Just try to do so as quietly as possible. So does anyone have questions for our speakers? Yeah.
I have to go, but can you come to a Seder at my house, please?
I would love to.
For the last speaker, did you, I don't know if you were aware of this, but in Los Angeles, there's a museum called the Skirball Museum. It's dedicated to studying Jewish history and art.
Right.
And a few years ago, they actually had a display, or a whole exhibit, about the Jewishness of comic books heroes.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
That they were talking about Superman and how all the people who were involved in the early days of Marvel and DC were Jewish.
Yeah.
So
what's the name of the museum again?
You know, the museum is the Skirball Museum. It was
okay.
Many years ago that they had this exhibit, but you may be able to
find some
information.
I'll search for it online. Yeah, thanks. Awesome.
This question is for Mr. Smith, I think, the second speaker.
Yeah.
So, and this might be alienating other people in the room, I don't know, but I've been reading X-Men Legacy and All New X-Men, and Uncanny, which has obviously convergent storylines to some degree because it's Marvel and it's an X title. But it's interesting because Bendis is doing his thing with, okay, now Cyclops is militant, but we're still talking about the same issues that we're talking about in the future past in terms of the other and you know, the pretty obvious and sometimes hammer-handed metaphor of race relations. And then Spurrier's take, have you been reading X-Men Legacy at all?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, so Spurrier's take is really interesting because I think his main drive is not necessarily to talk about those things, but because it's an ex-book and because it interlocks with all those other titles, he's having to address those issues, and that it's coming from a completely different angle that's really interesting. I was wondering if you had anything to say about that, because I've been having a hard time wrapping my head around it in terms of, I love this, but what does it mean?
It's a great question. I think that some of the comics that I've read recently have been able to sort of put a lot of that race relations stuff into the background, because I think it's been so well established in the canon from people like Claremont, like back in the day. It just seems to be now. I mean, the movies really play that up to the nth degree as well, so we're really getting hammered with all of that imagery and iconography. What's great about it is that the X-Men stand for any minority. You can literally insert, they're literally X-Men, a variable, put in whatever it is that you identify with and they represent you. So I've heard arguments about how it's the homosexual. I know that Bryan Singer has spoken out about that. Obviously the Jew.
Because Kitty just had that speech a few weeks
ago. Exactly, right. And so I think that the themes are timeless, which is what gives it its sort of timeless quality. And it's fascinating to see storylines like when, as you say, Cyclops became more militant. I remember the X-Men versus Avengers thing that was very predominant. He seemed very much, this is our time. You're not going to take this from us. This is our final, this is our big opportunity, right? And so he moves into a more militant camp, moving himself sort of closer to Magneto. And I'll leave it at this if other questions come up. But there's a part of my paper that I don't get to read because of the shortness of time. But very interesting parallel between Xavier and Magneto and King and Malcolm X could be made. Ultimately, I found that the parallel sort of fell apart on the Malcolm X side, but nevertheless, there's a lot of room there to have a very interesting dialogue about it. But yeah, just as a brief overview of your question, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Lucia. Thank you for a very interesting presentation, sir. I'd like to continue on that. And in a recent issue of Uncanny Avengers, there was a speech that Alex Summers gave about that we should not use the word mutant to describe people. I wonder what's your take on that?
The term mutant?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was actually in part of my paper. I cut it out. They're using the term muties and freaks throughout all of it. And then it occurred while I was writing it. I'm like, wait a minute, the word mutant itself is kind of derogatory. So this like derogatory term is culled from an already derogatory term. Already, they're setting themselves up, just the humanity is setting them up as something, they're labeling them something. That then, I think the significance here is that they come to personify that, they come to buy into that image that you are necessarily, essentially different. You're distinct, and you don't want to be different. You don't want to be a mutant, you want to be more like us. And I thought, and again, X-Men The Last Stand was not good. Not a good movie, I didn't think. But one really interesting aspect is all of the people that were lining up to get the cure. So many, there was a real point of contention. Everybody wanted to be cured because they didn't want that label anymore. Not because they rejected it, but because they came to identify with it, which I think is part of the real insidious power of the term mutant. Conversely, they're going around calling themselves homo superior, which already sets up a sort of antagonism between them and humanity as something that is, but if they are homo superior, then the label for humanity would be homo inferior, homo sapien, homo inferior, which, so the use of labels and what we call ourselves and what we call other people has an immense amount of power. They're just words, but when you come to identify with them and identify other people as them, really bad things can happen.
So you don't think that the X-Men have a reclaimed mutant as a word?
That's a really good question. You know, do they want to reclaim the mutant? I don't know. I mean, that's a great question. Do you want to reclaim this word? So you see a lot of words that, some member of the power majority, white people, men, heterosexual people, I'm not going to use any derogatory terms here, but the derogatory terms they use, you have a fight against, we don't want to hear that anymore. Stop saying that word. And then conversely, you have a lot of people that say, well, you know what? We're going to reclaim it. It's going to be our word. We're going to take it on ourselves as a show that we're not afraid of that use anymore. So I've heard both sides of it, and it's very interesting and important topic. Thank you.
Very, probably very similar to how we all identify as a nerd or a geek.
Yeah.
But now we've taken
claim
that.
It.
It's our word now. You can't use that word.
John. This is for our Green Lantern presenter. There's an issue with your articulation of Green Lantern as the all-American hero. Granted, he embodies all of these themes that you've brought up, yet you end before Coast City is destroyed and Parallax and...
And before a lot of things happen.
Which, now, in ending before these lots of things happening, Parallax, Coast City, etc., does that change your narrative? Or does that change your projection of Green Lantern as this all-American hero? Because could you draw parallels between the turning again with the unpopular support of the government by the American people in our current era, as preempted by the Parallax crisis, what happens with the Guardians of the Galaxy, the decimation and reformation of the Green Lantern Corps, all of these things?
Well, has America ever been consumed by fear? And then following America's consumption by fear, did we ever think that we wielded the sword of justice? I think that's a case almost entirely throughout the Cold War, where it's like, the Vietnamese do not know how to run their own country. We're going to go in there. Because if the Vietnamese don't run their country, wherever Vietnam is, we have to make sure they run their own country, or else we're going to be destroyed by Vietnam. That kind of plays into like this idea of Parallax kind of reoccurring throughout the United States. I think that America ceased to be this very simple black and white business, you know? Even like, what does the Green Lanterns replace, right? They replace the Manhunters. The Manhunters are obviously fascist, right? They have absolutely no emotion. No man escapes the Manhunters. And so that's like a very easy way that Americans kind of comfort themselves. And we see in the past 10 years with the stuff that Jeff Johns did, is, you know, he said, look, politics in the world are no longer fear and willpower, right? Politics in the world involve love, they involve compassion, they involve hope, they involve greed. I think the inclusion of avarice as one of the Green Lantern rings, I think, speaks so loudly to this trend that I find in Green Lantern comics. I don't know, does that answer your question?
Not quite.
All right. Good. I want to know my email address. I'd be happy to go on with this and to hear your ideas as well.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make a comment based off of the conversation that you guys were having a minute ago about what mutants determine to call themselves. Because one thing that I want to, even in how you framed it, you have to understand that people are people, and everyone who considers themselves a mutant, like you said, well, they started calling themselves Homo Superior. I'm sure there were tons of mutants, X-Men, mutants who had no affiliation whatsoever, who would not call themselves Homo Superior, who chose not because they didn't like what that term in particular implied. It's just like when some people tend to generalize, oh, well, black people want to do this or whatever, and it's like the whole argument of whether or not we want to or don't want to accept the N-word to try to remove the power from it, in the parallel of whether or not mutants want to take the power out of that term. Not all of us agree. Not all of us have the same perspective because we're different. We're different people. It's like when we always want to quantify whether or not we're a black American or white American or this community or the black community or the white community, it's not necessarily that we all agree. At the end of the day, we're Americans.
Right.
We're still Americans.
Yeah, and individuals too. That's a fantastic point. I think that really gets to the heart of this notion of otherness and Senator Kelly's problem with this notion of otherness, that he doesn't see individuals. He sees mutants in this blanketing term. They're all the same. They're all villainous, and he doesn't see the difference between hero and villain, and that any single one of them is put in the really unfair position of speaking on behalf of all mutants.
Yeah.
In the same way that, like you know, President Obama, suddenly he speaks for all black people. Well, why didn't Clinton speak for all white people? Why wasn't Bush speak for all white people? Why is that?
Perspective as well. It's like, at the end of the day, that he has, I'm the American president.
Right.
We don't have a separate president of black America or white America, whatever.
Right.
I guess the overall underlying point in that and the parallel is that it's a very fine line to walk, because I understand the empathy that people who are not a minority or not black or not female or whatever have in their discussion of trying to represent that perspective in a way that helps other people of their same, I don't want to say their same kind, that doesn't sound like they're different species or whatever, but of their same majority, yes, I know that's not a real word, but
it is now.
You know, to help portray that idea, because in the portrayal of that, you can sometimes perpetuate that very idea that you're trying to work against.
Exactly. No, that's exactly it. Which is almost identical to the point that Storm raised in the comic when she was accusing Senator Kelly of not allowing the same ambiguity, that different mutants will act differently in the same way that different humans will act differently. And I think it's really fantastic, the team that Claremont assembled for this. You put Storm in charge, and it was Storm that was leading that ideological battle. And of all the people in the X-Men, and she was talking about mutants.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about, like, you know, the color of her skin. I mean, she had, like, layer upon layer upon layer of otherness that she had to be wrestling with. So it was a great choice on this part.
Yeah.
Just to briefly touch on, like, Green Lantern post Parallax and all that, what could be more American, especially white, than Hal Jordan, after finding out about all these other different color rings, and they all come from different sectors, all these different perspectives on how the other rings work, who gets to wield all of them at the same time? Hal Jordan. and then what does Hal do once he meets, like, other lanterns? Like, he meets up with the Blue Lanterns. What's the first thing he tells them? Wow, hope's really powerful emotion, you guys. And then the Blue Lanterns in their polite way are like, yeah, Hal, that's fascinating. We only told you 100 times about this. But that was in response to that one of his questions.
I don't know if you noticed, when I showed Hiroshima, it had been destroyed, if you saw Hal's desperate, I just destroyed Coast City, move, photoshopped into it. But yeah, there's something, Hal's always, like, I love the Green Lantern fans who say, John Stewart is my favorite Green Lantern. Why? What has John Stewart done? He's blown up a bunch of planets. I think that a lot of people like John Stewart because they're like, well, he's black, and I'm going to like him because he's black. He's a really simple black character. Without a lot of, he's essentially like, he's a black Superman, right? Like he has more personality in the Justice League cartoons than in almost any other story. I'm talking with Van Jensen earlier, who writes Green Lantern Corps now, and he said, you know, he has two pressures on him right now. One is that people have a lot of hope that he's going to write a good John Stewart story, because there are so few that have been written. And ultimately, there's a lot of pressure because for some reason people have gotten it in their mind that he's going to write the great John Stewart story. And he doesn't have, you know, necessarily a template to even work from, because who is John Stewart? He's very cold, has very good posture, and he blows planets up.
There's more to John Stewart than him being cold and blowing planets up.
In the 70s, he had a bit more personality than he did as he sort of started to develop as kind of this invisible character. But if you want to come and defend him, I'm happy to hear it.
Uh-huh.
Or any of you. I just find John Stewart, and I find like Guy Gardner is so redheaded, you know? Kyle Rayner has...
Excuse me, what?
Ferris is such a woman. There is this... Green Lantern is...
You know?
Alright, Ayn Rand and Green Lantern have nothing more in common than the fact that all of Ayn Rand's characters are like, I represent individualism. I represent the burden of romantic love. I represent the military-industrial complex. And they speak like philosophers. They don't even speak like real people. And I think that in Green Lantern, a lot of characters end up, because it's a very hokey concept, your willpower, your love, your fear, your whatever else, and these characters really sort of like a Greek drama almost, like you are love, you are will, you are, you get kind of not undeveloped characters, but certainly not characters that we have in real life. You don't go to the workplace and go, oh, yeah, that's greed, and that's love, and that's this. Hopefully, you know, because we're individuals, right? We're not simply one emotion, I think. And I think that John Stewart, in a lot of cases, is kind of tossed off. And also, let's look at Space Sector 2814. Why are there four Green Lanterns from the United States of America in all of Space Sector 2814?
Right?
Yeah, or five, sorry, I forgot what time it was. But yeah, I mean, there's something about that just doesn't make any sense. Even if you want to say Earth is the most important spot in the universe, which, you know, that they allege, why is the United States so popular? Is it like somewhere in Washington, D.C., underneath the Washington Monument, that's how you get to all the other multiverses? I don't know.
Why do we need four for one sector?
Yeah, right? Well, it's because Earth has become so important. Because it is the center of the universe, according to the Green Men in the Valley.
about Superman in relation with the Gollum story quite a bit, but what about non-superpowered superheroes? How does that relate to, say, Batman or Green Arrow? Does that somehow make them inferior or superior because they arose to that idea of tikkun olam or protection without super speed or super strength?
No, I think that's a great question. But definitely, you see in Batman, I feel like he's coming from the same position of Superman. His wealth certainly makes up, because he can basically buy his superpowers, right? When you can buy that awesome a plane, who really needs to fly? So the point is that you come from a position of obligation to protect and defend, and Batman is very much motivated by that sense of noblesse oblige, right? That's that Wayne family idea, that because to him whom much has been given, much will be required. And so that, which I would also call very much a tikkun olam kind of idea, is motivating him maybe even more, because I think he feels a bit of guilt for having been handed everything that he's been handed, and therefore he is doubly obligated to give his life to the service of others. If that sort of answers your question.
Question for the third speaker about the comparisons you've made with Jewish folklore and some of Superman's properties. In later comics, could Superman himself, not as our social construct, but within his own stories, is he more of a cafeteria Catholic? Because there's a Kryptonian god, I think they call him Ra or something.
Rao.
And he only invokes Rao in the way that we would say God. He wants someone to call him on it, where he's like, oh, by the light of Rao. And it's like, you know who that is, Superman. Like, but he never refers to, like, the Kryptonian text of Rao. He just says it just as, like, an expression. It's like, you're not a Rao fan.
Yeah, no, I think that goes to the point of how... Yeah, he's not a real Ralph fan. I think that goes to...
That's the Superman mythology. There's that kind of book of Ralph.
Yeah, and I'm going to find it.
Smallville, that's like the whole basis of like the last six seasons is the book of Ralph.
Yeah. I think that that goes to the point that there is no real religious affiliation going on there, and to the degree that you could call Superman a cafeteria Kryptonian, he's very much reflecting, the writers are very much reflecting modern American sensibilities there, that there, no one's really that religiously devoted, right, and we're not going to depict the iconic American superhero as being intensely devoted to any one particular religion, for a lot of political reasons, but also for a lot of sociocultural ones, too, that sort of intense religious identity makes people uncomfortable.
Much like Superman's national identity as an American, right before the New 52, when he goes to the protest in Iran, and he says, you know, I don't want to be an American anymore.
Yeah, that wonderful Jane Fonda moment, yeah.
Okay. Who is Kyle Rayner, and how does he fall into your argument for you, sir?
How does Kyle Rayner fall into it for me? There is a point in America's understanding of ourselves, and this is all, again, lots of vague generalizations, that we start to feel that sensitivity is willpower, and where this harsh masculine Hal Jordan existed, this really obnoxious, annoying Guy Gardner exists, and John Stewart, this intimidating, broad shoulders, educated black man, what's scarier than that, right? And all of this is, you know, such willpower, right? You know, overcoming these odds, or just, you know, being in your face, or defying death by flying these planes. In the 1990s, America said, how can we be strong? By drawing pictures, talking about our feelings, getting rid of any kind of term that might be offensive, you know, you're vertically challenged instead of short, all this kind of stuff, where we became... our true strength of will is our ability to be non-offensive. And kind of Kyle Rayner, his big heroic moment, right, is where he defends his gay friend that gets beat up. And I don't know if that's this. I think that, you know, I would rather be like Kyle Rayner. Even though lots of people, you know, dog on him as a Green Lantern, I would rather my will be, the way I like to draw. I like, I don't want people to beat up. But this kind of replacement of
the immaturity of the United States in an optimistic way of saying that will is no longer defined by this very masculine thing that you do, but that by the content of your character rather than how many people you know. Where would you put Kyle into this kind of character?
Part of my question was, who was Kyle?
Oh,
I haven't really heard. I know that he's a Green Lantern, but I've never read anything with him.
Okay, he's a Green Lantern of the 90s when Grant Morrison redid the JLA. One thing that makes Kyle Rayner different than every other Green Lantern is that Ganthet gave him his ring rather than a Green Lantern dying and having his ring brought to him. He is known as being the most sensitive boy in the world. He's so emo, but he can wear all the rings after Hal Jordan wears all the rings because he's so masculine. Kyle can wear it because he's so feminine, since he's a very feminized male. And much like Jon Stewart, a lot of times people write stories about them with very little interest in the actual character. Unlike, I think, Hal Jordan and unlike Guy Gardner. And I think one of the reasons why Geoff Johns was so adamant about bringing Hal back is just because Kyle was not a character that worked as well as those other kind of brash versions of Will Packard.
Me?
No.
Okay.
Further back.
Me? Right.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I was just going to say in response to that that I feel like sometimes your sensitivity is the strongest form of willpower, and it's kind of sad to me that that would not be considered because
I think that's how Kyle is.
Down, right. So that's what I'm saying. So I think it's kind of sad overall that his character is not viewed as an appropriate Green Lantern because if you think of, especially like, I'm sorry, I'm black, so I think of a lot of parallels in like black history, but a lot of, you know, like Nikki Schwerner and a lot of white civil rights activists who had to take the unpopular route and have that emotional connection to people who were not like them. And to me, that takes a very strong sense of willpower because you then in yourself have to say, sometimes I feel like for Hal Jordan, it's easy to say, I'm going to defend this because it's right and blah, blah, blah. To me, it's 10 times harder for Kyle Rayner to say, you know what, you're probably going to beat my ass for defending my gay friend or whatever, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I feel sad sometimes, I guess it goes back to my point when what I was saying before in trying to make the point, you perpetuate the point where you actually describe Kyle Rayner as being very effeminate. Because I think that that's
and
part of the
effeminate as being a weakness and not a compliment, right?
Well, you were saying that he is one of the most feminine characters. And to me, when the term feminine is constantly used to describe sensitivity, to describe emotions, I mean, feminine is the opposite of masculine, right? So when people in general use that term to try to describe emotion, to try to describe sensitivity, you're making a parallel between the two, and therefore defining it as not masculine. If emotions equal feminine, and feminine does not equal masculine, then emotions
equal masculine.
I understand your
attack on my...
No, I'm sorry. I apologize greatly if you feel that I'm attacking you. So I apologize greatly if you feel that I'm attacking you. I'm definitely not trying to attack you. I'm just trying to
when I use those words, and I want to clarify this, I'm talking about perception of masculinity and perception of femininity, rather than, you know, what I consider, like I said, I like to draw, and I don't like to beat up, and like I said earlier, I'm sort of a D-squirrel, lazy, sensitive guy, you know, I like kindness over almost any other alternatives. And, you know, I would happily say that I learned that from my effeminate mother. I also learned that from my effeminate father, or my effeminate is not the word that I used. I used feminine.
Right. That's what I use the term effeminate. I didn't say that you used it.
Yeah, effeminate, I think, is I actually
saying that Kyle Rayner is feminine, or he's the most feminine of the Green Lanterns, to me, perpetuates the issue of why a more sensitive lantern or a more sensitive male character, period, is kind of looked down upon. To me, it perpetuates that ideal that men have to be strong and brash and blah, 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 because of the parallels that are constantly drawn between emotions and femininity.
And like in the New 52, DC assigns some of their worst writers the most sensitive characters.
And also the minority characters. Blue Beetle, Static Shock, Mr. Terrific. All those books have been canceled, right? Because they were given terrible writers, and they weren't very good books. Blue Beetle, I think, is better than the other two, the way that they've turned out. Well, Batman gets every great writer working in comics writing a book for him. And then when you look at the Green Lantern family, it was Jeff Johns, Peter Tomasi, Peter Milligan, and Tony Bedard wrote Kyle Rayner. So those first three Green Lantern books are written by icons of comics. And Tony Bedard, didn't have the same weight as Jeff Johns and Peter Tomasi. These characters don't get respected editorially, so when I disrespect them in this conversation, it's not the person that I'm disrespecting. I guess when I say that I don't understand why John Stewart is somebody's favorite Green Lantern. It's not because I don't think that me and John Stewart would be friends. I just think that the work hasn't been put into John Stewart to make him a meaningful character. I think that there's a revolution that happens with Kyle Rayner that Grant Morrison understands, and the writers after Grant Morrison failed to make happen.
I haven't read a whole lot of Green Lantern, but I did read Superman, the Red Sun issues of Superman, and it really struck me how Superman's quote-unquote Americanism translated really well into the Soviet Union sort of thing. Like, to me, he was pretty much basically the same Superman, only but with the same traits of strength and do goodness, for lack of a better word, and stuff. I was wondering if there's sort of a parallel in the Green Lantern universe, maybe somewhere in the different colors, or
I think Superman's pretty different in a lot of ways.
Somewhere around there, because it just struck me while you're talking about like Americanism, how transient that can be in a lot of different superhero comics. In Red Sun, someone
are great. In Red Sun, Superman is good, honest, strong, and heroic. None of those have anything to do with being American.
Oh.
He is a fascist, undemocratic, surveilling tyrant in Red Sun, which I think is un-American. I think that we like democracy, even after 4 days of Dragon Con, I still like the idea of democracy.
It struck me how his basic character traits stayed the same when his like politics completely switched. So, sorry, go ahead.
I think Red Sun's a great book. If you guys haven't read it, it's one of the best comics I've ever written. But if there's like a parallel of Green Lantern, Elseworld stories is what we usually call them. The Elseworld stories for the Green Lantern are generally pretty bad. Green Lantern as a total family has suffered from a lot of really, really bad writers. And even the stuff that I talked about today is not really that good. I think the best Green Lantern stuff is in the past 10 years. Good Elseworld stories for the Green Lantern.
I know there are more questions, and but we're past a half hour after the panel's supposed to end. I don't want to say that you guys all have to leave, but I want to let the presenters off the hook in case they're worn out or have somewhere they want to go. If they want to stick around and chat more, that's fine with me. You guys can stay in here. You all can stay in here as long as you want. I'm gonna go. but let's thank our speakers.